Welcome to Rails with Jason. Hey, I want to tell you about something. If you struggle with writing tests for your Rails applications, specifically RSpec tests, I have something for you. At my website, codewithjason.com, I have a whole bunch of articles on Rails testing that I wrote. Here's a couple examples of what you can find there. You can find a repeatable step-by-step guide to writing integration tests with Capybara. That's where I share my formula that I use every time I write a Capybara test that makes it pretty easy. There is the ultimate guide to RSpec and Capybara tests. And there's also mocks and stubs in plain English. These are just a few examples of dozens and dozens of Rails testing articles that I've written at codewithjason.com. I also have a free Ruby testing micro course that you can download. It's a four-part course, pretty easy to go through. Hundreds of developers have already downloaded the course. You can join them by going to codewithjason.com and downloading the micro course. I also have a book called Rails Testing for Beginners. The book can be purchased as just the book or the book plus a video package where I walk through the book and show you everything in the book. Again, all these things are available at codewithjason.com. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason. My guest today is Benedict Dyka, co-founder of UserList. Benedict, do you want to tell our listener about yourself and a little bit about UserList?
Sure. First of all, hi, everyone. I'm super happy to be here. To get started, what is UserList? UserList is a customer messaging tool for software as a service applications. We basically try to make it easy to set up onboarding campaigns and anything else that you might send to your customers once they signed up to your product. But we're trying to make it smart in a way that it also respects the behavior of the user and only sends email that are relevant and useful to people, and not just sending them a stupid time-based campaign with a lot of messages that are probably not relevant because they already did certain things and it doesn't make sense to explain it again. So we're trying to be smart about that. In essence, it's similar to tools like Intercom or Customer.io, but way easier to set up, not as complex, but still a lot faster than writing something yourself.
And you've been working on this product for a couple of years now?
Yeah, we started, like, the first idea, the idea originated in 2017. Late 2017, when my co-founder basically asked me and our third co-founder, Claire, if we want to do this. This was October 2017, and we recently launched in August 2019, so almost 2 years.
Oh, you only just launched in August?
Yeah, just about 4 weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And okay, so it's you and Claire and Jane Portman?
Yeah, Claire Sollentrop and Jane Portman.
Got it. And Jane Portman is a name that I was familiar with via, I think, Brennan Dunn. So if anybody listening is a follower of Brennan Dunn, then maybe, I think I actually heard Jane on Brennan's podcast is where I first heard about her. Or maybe it was somewhere else. I have no idea. Okay, so
she's been around for a while.
yeah. I think she does a lot of writing and speaking and stuff like that. I guess if anybody has been to MicroConf, then she's associated with those circles too. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the title of this podcast is Rails with Jason, which is a little bit funny because in most of the episodes I've put out so far, I haven't talked about like anything to do with Rails. So I'm going to try in this podcast to at least talk about Rails a little bit. So maybe if you're up for it, let's dive into some technical stuff for a
Absolutely.
Bit. Yeah. And then I'm also interested in like the business side of things and your personal background and all that. We'll see where everything takes us. So this, I assume, is a Rails application that you're building?
It is. It's a Rails application. It's a Rails application and front end in Ember.js. So the Rails backend is mostly API, except for a little small part with for unsubscribed pages and stuff like that that get rendered out to actual end users. But that's about all of the HTML that comes directly from the Rails application. Everything else is in a front end separate repository, Ember.js repository that just talks to the API.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. Is it client server architecture where it's two completely separate applications? Sounds like the answer is yes.
Yeah, yes, it's completely separate. And okay. That's, I don't know, that pattern worked for me in the past, and that's why I just kept going with it. I know that JavaScript integration in Rails is a little bit better these days, so maybe it's possible to pull it off in one. But as I said, from past experience, having two repositories worked well for me and deploys are so much quicker now that it's separated. And I can deploy changes to the front end independently from changes to the back end, and that makes it quite useful.
Okay, so let's give the listener a little bit of context.
For jumping right in.
Oh, no, that's okay. So before this episode, I did a little bit of cyber stalking on you like usual. And it looks like you've been doing Rails for like a pretty long time. When did you start using Rails?
I don't remember the year, but I remember that just after I got started, Rails 1.2 was released. So yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, so a pretty long time. And so my assumption, based on the fact that you started a new Rails Ember application in like late 2017, my assumption would be that you had a background with that Rails Ember combo. Because like somebody probably isn't going to pick the Rails Ember combo if like that's their first foray into client server applications and JavaScript heavy applications and stuff like that. Like they're probably going to reach for one of the newer, shinier tools. I'm guessing that you chose Ember because you'd used it before and you liked it. Is that the right assumption?
That's absolutely the right assumption. Yeah, I built another product before UserList that used that combination. It even like when that product started, Ember wasn't even called Ember. It was the Sprout Core 2.0. So I was familiar with the setup. And I still like it. Like, I didn't see a reason to switch to something else. And so, yeah, I just decided to keep going with it.
You know, something that is really nice about building your own greenfield application, like, okay, so you and I think, have a somewhat similar situation in that I've been building a certain application for just over a year now where I'm the sole developer. We started from the ground up, and so I had complete autonomy to choose whatever technologies I wanted to. And that's just so nice. And, you know, I there was maybe a point in my career where if I were building something new and I had complete autonomy, that would mean that I would choose something new that I've never used before so I could get a chance to learn it. But yep. That's not where I'm at today. Now, if I get a chance to build something new, especially if the thing I'm building really matters for something, I'm not gonna try to learn a new technology at the same time. I'm just gonna reach for something I'm really comfortable with and that I know I like so that I can hit the ground running and just be super productive right from day one. And so that's exactly what I did. And it sounds like that's the choice that you made too, which I think is a really good way to go.
Yeah, definitely. But I learned this the hard way. Like with the previous product I've been building, I think I started over a couple of times before I realized it doesn't make sense to always like start from scratch and learn something new and try out new approaches and new technologies and new patterns and whatnot. Sometimes it's better to just pick the things you know and be productive with them instead of wasting a lot of time trying to learn something and usually not getting it right at the first time and then changing everything. And they have all this cruft that doesn't really work. And yeah, sometimes it's better to just use the tools you know.
What was this project that you were working on before this? Is that something you can talk about?
Sure, that's something I can talk about. It was a content management system for musicians, and it took me 10 years from first idea to actually launching it and shipping it.
Oh wow.
But like with all those learnings in between. Like, yeah. I had no idea what I was doing when I started out with it, and eventually it evolved from a scrappy PHP CMS to a multi-tenant Ruby on Rails application that actually had payment integrated and was launched and made some money.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what was the traction like from a business perspective?
Oh, let's not talk about that too much. It was horrible. I got some clients early on, but that's about it. Like, to this day, I think the maximum number of users I had on it was 6 or 7. And it's still up and running today, but like selling to musicians is tough. I can tell you.
Yeah, because like you're selling to people who are famously impoverished.
Yeah, either that or famous enough that it's hard to reach them.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, I don't know, I'm a musician. Are you a musician too?
I'm not a musician. I know some basics on the drums, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, yeah, like for me as a musician, like I'm a musician and a computer guy, obviously. Mm-hmm. And never in my music career spanning, doing a little math in my head, 35 minus 14, I think is 21 years. Never in 21 years did I look for like some kind of CMS for my music stuff, not to like rub in this like failed product idea or whatever, but it just kind of illustrates how that kind of thing can go. I went through a similarly painful experience. So in 2011, I started building, I'll try to give the short version of this story, but I built scheduling software for hair salons. And that was a similar experience in the sense that at my very peak, I think I had 10 salons using it. My peak revenue was like $430 a month. Mm. And this was over the span of 5 years. And I spent so much time and energy on it. And I was expecting that this was going to be, you know, my escape route to financial freedom or whatever. And it just never worked out that way. It's a really painful path, but it's very common.
Yeah, it's totally similar like to my path with the CMS. But I mean, in hindsight, I learned so many things. Like I learned so many things how not to do it. So in a way, it was worth it, even though financials wise, it was a disaster.
Was this your first business attempt or not?
In a way, yes. I mean, I've been freelancing on the side for years, but this was my first foray into products and software as a service.
Yeah. Mine. I had a small handful of attempts before that are like almost not worth counting because they were so small and just such egregiously stupid ideas and lasted for such a short amount of time. Like just to give one quick example of like the level of stupidity of these ideas was one was a website where you could submit a drawing idea and I would go through the list and make you a drawing. Like one guy had an idea for a drawing. He's like, I want you to draw me a guy riding a motorcycle made out of bears. And the motorcycle has an American flag on it. And the guy's holding a shotgun. And there was some other stuff. I think maybe he was drinking a beer. I don't remember. And I drew that drawing. And it took me hours and hours. And then I was like, this is what I signed up to do? Like, this is my business? This is terrible. So I shut that down after one drawing and a lot of broken promises. a lot of drawing ideas undrawn.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had a handful of those. And, you know, I think the vast majority of business ideas are terrible, because coming up with good business ideas is really hard. And in fact, I think the way that people come up with good business ideas is you don't brainstorm up a business idea, you stumble upon a business idea in the course of doing something else. Like if you look at any successful business, any successful like product business online, it's not something that they could have just brainstormed up. It's something that they stumbled across. So let me ask you this. What was the genesis of Userless? How did that come about?
So before founding Userless, Jane and I worked on another product together. Actually, it was her product idea, and she hired me to build it. And well, for one, it was super fun to work with her, so that made it easy to later join forces. But in the process, we were at a point where we had a basic application built, and then we're wondering, yeah, okay, so let's actually figure out who are actually the users using it, and what are they doing inside the app, and we should probably also send them messages and tell them about new features, and maybe have an onboarding campaign. And back then, we looked at the options out there and the basically solutions. And Intercom was somewhat of a good fit, but it was way too much. Like we wouldn't want to have a live chat and stuff like that. So there was this idea of just building a simple thing that just does the automated messaging without all that other stuff that Intercom does these days. Okay. And yeah, that's where it started.
And what was this other product of Jane's?
It was called, and it's still called, Tiny Reminder. I think it's still up and running. It was a tool for example, freelancers to ask people to submit a form, like a client intake form, for example, where you ask a couple of questions. Maybe they need to upload some files that you need to get started with the product. And it will send them reminders to submit that form until they do so.
Got it. Okay. And so out of that, you kind of scratched your own itch with the reminder stuff, and that kind of spun off into its own product. What made you guys believe that this was something that other people would want to use and pay for?
So for one, there are competitors out there, so it's not an entirely new market. There are a couple of similar products, like I mentioned, Intercom, Customer.io, Mixpanel does this stuff as well. So it was obvious that there is some need for it, because otherwise those other products wouldn't exist. But then we also made an effort to interview a lot of people and potential customers before we actually started building stuff. So in the first 2 to 3 months, Claire did a lot of interviews with potential customers, founders of software service applications, and basically try to verify that this is actually a need and this is actually a problem that people are having. And that was helpful in confirming that this is actually something worth pursuing.
And do the three of you co-founders have distinct roles? Obviously, like, you're probably wearing the programmer hat most of the time, but do you have actual like titles and roles and stuff like that, or do you just do kind of whatever needs to be done?
A little bit of both. So as I said before the recording, I don't believe in titles, but we have our specialties, I guess. So Jane is a very good UI and UX designer, and also good at like coming up with product ideas and product concepts. Claire does a lot of marketing, so she's our marketing expert, and I'm taking care of building the stuff and have the engineering hat on.
Nice. Okay, so like I'm gonna try to get back to the technical stuff. So it's a Rails and Ember app. You have two separate repos. Okay, so this is an interesting topic because I generally don't like that. approach. and so let me ask you some questions about, like, in your view, the pros and cons and stuff like that. And I'm sure that you don't advocate, like, that kind of client server architecture for every single use case. I'm sure you had good reasons for choosing that architecture for that particular project. But what led you to do it that way instead of just, say, a traditional Rails application with very little JavaScript, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I'm not advocating for that particular setup for every single application, as you said. For example, Tiny Reminder was just a plain old Rails app without much JavaScript. But, like, for UserList, I had in mind that it would eventually have a really nice user interface that's very flexible and interactive. And usually when I want to build stuff like that in plain old Rails, that usually gets complicated very quickly, and I keep reinventing the wheel. So
in what I decided way do you to mean?
like just managing state on the front end. Like, for example, you want to click a button there and update three parts of the application at the same time without doing a round trip to the server and stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. for example, simple stuff like marking a message as unread and have the counter decrease in one or two places at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Like the unread counter. So stuff like that usually gets quite messy.
You know, here's how I've been JavaScript dealing with that. So I'll share a little bit about how I've been structuring my application that I've been building for sure. the last year. So my goal, my ideal, my absolute ideal, which is an unachievable ideal, but it's like the North Star, is yeah. no JavaScript. Obviously, that can't be done. So, you know, at least as little JavaScript as possible. And what I'm discovering a year in is that even as little JavaScript as possible is still kind of a lot of JavaScript. So there's kind of no getting around it, because there's just, like, there's certain kinds of UIs where you just need some JavaScript in order for it to behave in a way that's like what you want. So that was kind of my ideal. And so for the vast majority of the project's existence, maybe until a month ago, there was no front-end framework or anything like that. It was just vanilla JavaScript. Lately, I've been using Stimulus, which maybe we can get into, but I wanted to address what you said about managing state, because that is tricky to do. The way that I've been handling that is, like, okay, there is a certain page in this application where you have, like, a list of appointments, and for each appointment, you can kind of edit the details of that appointment all in the same page. And sometimes you will do something in one appointment that can affect the whole list of appointments and stuff like that. And so rather yeah. than saying, like, in your example, like, you change something and it updates a counter in three places or something like that, I'll just have, like, a div on the page where, like, that div contains the entire list of appointments. And then when anything changes on one appointment, I'll hit the server, get some server rendered HTML, and just load that entire div that contains all those appointments and update it that way. That way it's kind of like I think Ember has that idea of, like, actions up, data down. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So at a broad level, I think it's a similar concept where I'm not going in and making, like, minute changes in various places on the page. I'm just saying to the server, hey, this thing happened. And then the server's saying, oh, okay, a thing happened. Here's the whole entire chunk of that page in its new full state. And that way I don't have to worry about the little details of it. It's just the whole thing.
Yeah, sure. That's definitely a valid approach. And I'm not saying that you should always do, like, separate apps. As we talked about previously, I was comfortable with that setup, so I just kept going with it. I'm pretty sure we could achieve similar results with a different setup as well. But so far it worked well for us.
Yeah. No, and this is not the Benedict is wrong show. I'm not gonna do that.
I didn't have the feeling that it was that. As I said, there are various approaches to build this. I think where it gets tricky usually with just like relying on server-side rendering for parts of the application, I usually run into stuff where I start with, like as you said, just sending a call to the server to get that one part, but like replacing the diff. But then like 2 months after, I get some behavior that should also affect some entirely other part of the page. And then it's usually back to I don't know, either figure out some JavaScript hackery that rendered partial from the server also triggers a call that updates some other part of the page, or stuff like that. So sometimes I feel like it's easier to just like not do anything of like this at all and just like replace the entire page in one go.
Yeah, I think that is usually easier to think about. I think maybe a related idea, or maybe this is exactly the idea, is immutability. So like generally immutability is good because, and tell me if you like think about this in this way or a different way, immutability is good because immutable things are easier to think about than mutable things. That's kind of how I think about that, I think. Do you think about that the same way or not? Or is that maybe not even something that you think about in that way? I don't know if that question made any sense at all.
I think I get what you're trying to say. Sometimes like mutability feels like a quick and easy win. Like I just update this attribute and everything else is fine and updates automatically. And it works for simple solutions, but the more complex it gets, the easier it is to shoot yourself in the foot with it.
Oh, really?
And that's my experience. Like I remember building one quite complex component in user list that basically allows people to build their own filters to filter down the list of users by combining various like conditions, like email address should include this and name should not end with whatever, and building the UI for that. My first approach was using mutable objects and then basically building this tree of options and letting the UI components update parts of the tree. But it eventually got so complicated and so messy that it was hard to reason about, hard to debug. And the second iteration was basically just passing immutable objects up and down the graph of the component graph. And that made it so much more easier to think about it and reason about it, because you could be sure that this object is not going to change. And if it does, you get an entirely new object passed in from your parent component, for example.
Yeah.
And that makes it easier then.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of where I learned about immutability or where I read about it. It was something that I don't know. It's an idea that's like not too hard to like arrive at from first principles without even like learning about it from the outside. But I've definitely read about it somewhere. I think it was maybe that domain-driven design book, which I'm trudging through very slowly because it's a difficult read. So let's go back for a second to that like actions up. Actions up, data down. Is that something that you're familiar with? Because I've used Ember a little bit, but I am like an Ember amateur. Is that something you're familiar enough to talk about, the data up, actions up, data down thing?
Yeah, essentially it very much relates to what I just said. Like the way it is supposed to work is that you have components in your view For example, you have to, a component that has many subcomponents that,
and that's an actual Ember concept, a component.
Yeah, components are like an essential concept in Ember where you basically represent UI elements using components. For example, a button is a component and an input field is a component. And okay. I guess the input field is already a good example for data down, actions up, because like in the initial versions of Ember, the how the input field would work is that you pass it a value, like say value is attribute one. And whenever you type something into that input field, it would automatically update the attribute with the new value, and everything else in the UI would change accordingly. And as I said, at first, this is super powerful. Like you just add a few lines of code and magic happens. Your entire UI updates automatically and stuff like that. But eventually you realize that it gets very messy because you never know when things will change, and suddenly change happens without you knowing where it came from. So the idea of data down, actions up is basically, instead of the input field automatically updating the attribute, you just pass in the value initially, and then instead of updating the attribute, the input field would send an action up, and an action is basically just a method call on the parent component or whatever parent object that instantiated that component, and let the parent decide what to do with that notification about the change, if it would wants to update the value or do something else with it. Does it make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
It's a bit hard to explain without pointing at a whiteboard.
Yeah, podcasts are actually kind of a terrible format for technical stuff because you can't see stuff. At least I'm a visual person, so I absorb stuff better visually, at least when it's like fine-grained technical details. But no, I think I grasped that. And I recently did a similar thing in my vanilla JavaScript stuff. Like I have these type ahead fields in my application, and there's different type ahead fields for different purposes sprinkled throughout the application. And it turned out that there was, you know, like many months into these type ahead fields existing, it turned out we needed one of the type ahead field types to do something special at the time that a value was selected in that type ahead field. And one way I could have done it was like to add some kind of hook to say, like, if this type ahead field is this certain type of type ahead field and I'm on this certain page, then do this thing. Otherwise, don't do anything. But I don't really like that a lot for some reason. What I chose to do instead was I said, anytime any type ahead field has something selected, broadcast an event. And then I had an event listener that did the thing that needed to be done in that one certain case. And it was that event listener that was responsible for like knowing the special details of itself, the type ahead, like the generic multi-use type ahead didn't have to know something about that more specific use case. And I think that's a better way to do it.
Yeah. I think that's a similar concept. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a better way to, when I said, I think that's a better way to do it, I mean, I think it's a better way for the more specific thing, like the lower level child thing should, well, no, what am I saying even? Well, it's not good for like the generic thing to know something about some special case, you know?
Yeah.
And I think
that setup, you can make the autocomplete field. It doesn't need to know anything about what the values are and what type it is. It just needs to do its one job and then pass the responsibility of handling whatever happens with the value that got selected up to whoever called it.
Yeah. And my point was that it's kind of mirrors what you said about like the, you have the field and you change the value. That field is not responsible for knowing what to do. It just sends the action up and says, hey, parent object or whatever, this thing changed. You decide what to do with it. I think that's better than the other way around.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. This is an Ember and Rails application. How are you hosting it? Are you hosting the Ember and the Rails applications in two different places or somehow together? How does that work?
It's two separate places right now. The Rails app is running on Heroku, and the Ember application is running on Netlify.
What's Netlify?
Netlify is a really cool hosting platform for static websites and single page applications. So similar to Heroku, it just hooks into your Git repository, and whenever you push, it pulls the code, runs the build process, and then pushes the results into their CDN. So yeah, you basically update your website by pushing to GitHub.
Oh, okay.
That is a little bit like GitHub Pages on steroids.
Yeah. I like that idea. And are you pretty much just sending JSON to and from the server as opposed to like server rendered HTML?
Yeah, the API is based on the JSON API spec, and it just sends objects like JSON API objects back and forth between the client and the server.
What is the JSON API spec?
It's basically a standard that defines how those objects look like and how they define their attributes and the relationships. And it also has some tools to figure out side loading. For example, when you fetch an object that also has relationships to two other objects, you can use a, like query param to tell the server, please also include all the objects that aren't of that type but are related to that, and that's one response. So you, instead of making a couple round trips to the server, you get everything in one go.
Okay. I'm looking at the JSON API website right now. It says, if you've ever argued with your team about the way your JSON responses should be formatted, JSON API can be your anti-bike shedding tool. Yes. I really like that idea.
Yeah, so it's essentially a standard that defines most of the cases you run into and makes it easy to reason about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that idea of just using an outside specification rather than making arbitrary decisions within the team. And I'm looking at this, so on the JSON API site, they have like an example response, and it looks pretty much like any Rails response that I would have seen, but it's like formatted in a specific way and stuff like that. And it looks like it implements, I don't know if I'm going to get this right or get this totally wrong, but it's, what is it called? It's called hyper something or other. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. I don't remember the exact name either, but yeah, the idea of embedding links to other resources. So you'd be able to figure out what to call next to get a resource or a relationship. That's this concept, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a self-discoverable thing. So like maybe you don't have API docs or something like that, or like you want an application to be able to navigate some API. The JSON response will contain like some metadata about the API. So that you could, like in this example here, there is a links, what's the word? There's a links key. And then the values under that key contain the keys of self, next, and last, each of which has a URL associated with it. So that's kind of interesting. The acronym HateOS comes to mind. I don't know if that's something.
Yeah.
HateOAS. And this is hypermedia as the engine of application state. I don't know if this is actually anything related or not. That's just an acronym. Oh, hypermedia. Hypermedia, I think, was the thing that I was thinking of.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. Yeah, hypermedia.
All right. Well, I'll let anybody who's interested in that go and Google that themselves instead of listen to me Google it and read you what I find. So this is pretty interesting. Have you, Benedict, messed around at all by chance with GraphQL?
I have not. And the only reason why I haven't is because JSON API is good enough for me right now.
Yeah, I haven't done anything with GraphQL either. You know, I had this infuriating moment like a few months ago. I was teaching this class. This class was comprised of like recent college graduates. And, you know, it's really fascinating. And I think you'll appreciate this, Benedict, because I think you've been programming for a similar amount of time as me. It's amazing what new programmers these days both don't know and what they've been indoctrinated to believe. So, like, I was talking to this programmer. He was, like, in his early 20s. He didn't even know that it was possible to have a web application render HTML. Like, he thought client-server architecture was, like, the only possible thing. Like, and that was pretty interesting. And I was teaching him, like, about databases and the relational model and stuff like that. And he's like, well, this is stupid. Like, GraphQL is better. I'm just like, fuck, like, this, no. Like, that's, I know that you're not right about that. But unfortunately, I'm not familiar with GraphQL. I can say confidently that I'm sure GraphQL doesn't just, like, completely invalidate the entire relational model concept and make relational databases irrelevant and useless. Like, I know that that's the case, but I don't have, like, the knowledge to articulate exactly why, because I've never used GraphQL.
Yeah. I feel like GraphQL and SQL are actually quite similar in what they want to achieve. Like, basically querying a database, and in GraphQL, it's not really a database, but your application. But essentially, it's still, give me some data and use these relationships to do this. So
Yeah. And the part that makes me upset is now I feel like burdened to go and learn GraphQL just so I can explain to this one person on this one occasion why he's wrong. and that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It's more than just that. Like, I feel like, I don't know, there's a lot of crazy technologies that come out, and, like, in order to explain why they are not, like, the silver bullet that supersedes all existing tried and true technologies, in order to explain that stuff, you have to understand these new technologies to a certain extent, which is a little bit frustrating. Like, I'm so glad that the wave of, like, MongoDB and all that kind of stuff has passed. Like, the internet went through, like, this maturing stage where everybody was like, relational databases are slow and stupid and they're old-fashioned, and the way to do things now is MongoDB. And then people realized, oh, wait, it's like relational databases have been around for many decades for a reason, and this new thing is not better in all situations. And so, we've kind of overcame that. So I'm glad that, like, I don't have to go and learn MongoDB and have that argument over and over again, because now people have kind of realized that.
Yeah. I guess my feeling is, that we are always like a pendulum between the extremes. every couple of years, it either swings in this or the other direction. And sometimes for example, relational databases are the cool thing. And I'm pretty sure in a couple of years, something like MongoDB or document-based databases will be cool again. And I feel like it always alternates between two extremes in whatever you look at. Same with like the recent thing with embedding CSS in HTML, and I don't know, 10 years ago it was like, oh, keep them apart as much as you can, and now we're back at merging everything into one file and not separating concerns. And I'm sure like in a couple of years we'll try everything to rip it apart again. So
what's the your truth opinion is probably what's your opinion on that separation of concerns thing?
I still try to separate my markup from my styling, but mostly because that's what I used to do and it works well for me. And yeah, I don't know.
And mixing all that stuff together is crazy.
Yeah, like, but I mean, some people insanity. Seem to like it.
Yeah, but it's nuts.
Yeah, that's probably my take on it. Old people ranting about new computer stuff.
Well, it's not just like blind ranting against new stuff, because, you know, I adopt new ideas when those new ideas are valid. But like the idea of, you know, separation of concerns exists for a reason. And I think if we were to articulate this reason, it is that like it's easier to think about styling separate from behavior on an HTML page and separate from structure. Also, it's easier to think about all those three things separately than it is to mush them all together and understand all those things as one combined piece. I think that's why separation of concerns is compelling. Does that seem right?
Yeah, I think I agree. But I mean, there's also this argument of having everything related to one piece. Like, let's talk about, like, if we talk about components in HTML and like React or something, having everything in one place together, we can see like where it looks, what it looks like and how it behaves, like in one file, also has its appeal in a way.
That's true.
I still would do it, but like there, as with everything in computer science and programming, there's always pros and cons, and you're constantly trying to go the path that has the least downsides and the most upsides for your particular solution or your particular problems.
Here's my thought on that, and tell me if you agree or not. Like the component idea is attractive to me in certain ways. When I used to work with Angular, Angular kind of has that concept. It seems like the consensus is, or at least was in the Angular world, that the way you organize your projects and structure your file hierarchy is that you organize it based on components. So in one folder, you might have a JS file, an HTML file, a CSS file, etc., as opposed to having it the way Rails does it, where all your CSS is in one directory, all your JavaScript is one directory, etc. That's attractive to me in certain ways, and it's logical to me in certain ways. But here's, I think, what is like the fatal flaw of that idea. If you separate your files by concern, like the way Rails does it, having all your JavaScript in one directory, etc., that's always going to be possible. Like, you can always categorize things in that way. Whereas with the component-based thing, it seems like I would run into cases where, like, it's ambiguous which component something belongs to. Like, something is shared by two or more components, in which case it no longer is clear. Like, it's no longer logically possible to separate those things that way. And maybe there's just something I don't know about it, but it seems that's like the problem I ran into with that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
How does Ember do it? Does it separate it like Rails, or does it separate it like Angular, where it's component-based file hierarchy?
It does a little bit of both. Like, you can, I think when you set up the project, you can basically choose what file layout to use, and it either like then separates it by type or by component. I think the default is still like sorting stuff by type, but I think they are going to change it soonish. But I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. What version of Ember are we at these days?
I think it's 3.12.
Okay. Yeah, I think at the last place we worked, we were like a major version behind, so we must have been on version 2. Is version 3 a lot different from 2, or is it pretty similar?
What I like about Ember is that basically since the very early 1. Whatever versions, they try to be as backwards compatible as possible. So the upgrade path has always been super smooth, and they're just gradually adding new patterns and features. So in a way, it's still similar, but leading up to, I think, 3.14, they are introducing a lot of new stuff and a lot of new patterns that are super exciting, and basically making Ember play more nicely with the current JavaScript ecosystem, and for example embracing JavaScript classes which weren't even a thing when Ember started out, and basically adopting all the new things that the JavaScript platform now supports, and making that these concepts part of Ember, and that's really cool. Like, I think it's 3.14 release will be pretty exciting.
Yeah, JavaScript got so much more palatable once ES6 came along and they introduced things like classes and all that other new stuff that came along with it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's probably time to start heading toward a conclusion here. I might ask you one or two more questions, and then I'll ask you the usual question of where can people find you online, where can they learn more about user list and stuff like that. Let me completely switch topics and ask you a different kind of question. So you had mentioned to me that user list launched in August. What did that look like? Were you just kind of building and I hate the term stealth mode, but were you building in stealth mode for that time? Were you doing some like getting a list of interested people? Like, how did that whole launch and building up to the launch go?
So we did not build in stealth mode, quite the opposite. I think one of the first things we did before we even knew what the product would look like was setting up a landing page and a mailing list so you could sign up for it. And it was super simple, just like, we're building a new tool that roughly does this. If you're interested, sign up for the mailing list. And then we kept basically sending that email list weekly updates about what we are currently working on, what we are thinking, what ideas we have around that product, and try to grow the list that way.
Yeah, that's a great way to do it. I'm doing a similar thing with a new product I'm building, which, long story short, is a way to run tests really fast. And I'm deliberately not putting very much effort into the technical parts of the product or building the product. First, I'm like building the marketing site where I can collect some emails and stuff like that. Because obviously it's pointless to put a whole bunch of effort into the product before you know people are going to be interested.
Yeah. And like after that, we did a pre-order period where people could like actually pay us a little bit to get early access but at this stage we didn't have the product, so it was basically you can sign up now, you get a nice discount for 6 months, and you'll get access to the product as one of the first when it's in a state that is actually usable. And after we did that, we knew that we at least were onto something, that like a couple of people were actually willing to pay for it. And then we basically started building the product and eventually onboarding those early customers. And I think we had the first people on there in November 2018, I guess, and then used that early customer base to fine tune the product and add things they needed until we were at a stage where it was obvious that the product was mature enough to finally launch it to a wider audience.
Yeah, doing things in that way is so much better than like the approach that I took with my hair salon thing. I built the whole entire product and then I went out and started trying to sell it. That was rough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I made that mistake myself before, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, hey, the hard part's over. I built it. Now I just have to sell it. Oh, wait.
Nobody wants it.
Yeah.
Nobody knows about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was tough. Okay, so last question. Where can people go to learn more about you, more about UserList, all that stuff?
About UserList, the best place to get started is userlist.io. That's our website. We're also on Twitter as userlist.io. We usually share a lot of our progress there and what we're up to. And if you want to follow me, I'm Benedikt Dyker on Twitter. You should probably put that in the show notes somewhere.
Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes for sure.
I don't expect people to spell that right at the first try. If you want to follow along like the development side and the business side of building UserList, I'm also running a podcast with my friend Brian Ray, and that one is called Slow and Steady, and the website is slowandsteadypodcast.com.
Awesome. Well, Benedikt, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.